The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Okay, great. So, today I want to talk about what at first will seem like a maybe unusual topic, maybe because it's not immediately obvious. It has to do with the kind of mindfulness meditation that we do. But it's an important topic, I think, for Buddhism and for Buddhists. And many people come and ask me questions about what's happening in Burma and also in Sri Lanka with these Buddhist countries where some of us have gone to practice and been very influential for us in our practice and our encounter with Buddhism. And now we have Buddhist-incited violence in these countries. And we have people being arrested for what's called blasphemy. And recently there was a few years ago, there was a man from New Zealand who was working at a bar in Yangon. And in order to get people to come, he had a poster made of the Buddha statue with headphones on. And this was considered blasphemy, and he was sentenced to 2.5 years in jail. So it's kind of that's kind of the mild version of what's happening in these countries. And then we have in Burma now, in Sri Lanka, we have Burmese and Buddha and Sinhalese monks who are quite nationalistic. Some of them that are inciting violence, and some of the violence against the Rohingya, the Muslims in Western Burma, is fueled by some of these ultra-nationalist Buddhist monks who have a certain kind of hate speech that they speak, so much so that Times Magazine, a year or two ago, in their Asian edition, not in the here in America, on the cover they had a picture of this one particular monk, and in big letters it said something like "Buddhist terrorist." And most people don't associate Buddhism with terrorism, and so here it is. So I want to talk a little bit about this issue of blasphemy in Buddhism, and then I want to take you kind of on a little journey to once talking about it more broadly, and then bring it into something more directly connected to our practice here. So it starts with a story that in the suttas. In fact, this story is very important because it's the very first story in the ancient sacred scriptures of Buddhists. So the Buddhists have this very multi-volume, large kind of Bible, called suttas. None of it has to be the beginning, like the Bible has a beginning. But they're organized in a particular way. And the way they've been organized, there's a first sutta. And that first sutta, scripture, has a story that it begins with. And so it kind of is the gateway in to all these many, they say 18,000 scriptures that this ancient tradition attributes to the Buddha. And the story has to do with a wandering religious teacher whose name happens to be Well-Loved. And walking with his disciple, who happens to be called Divinely Given. So it's kind of nice. Well, they're walking along, and they happen to be walking right behind the Buddha, who's also walking through the countryside on a road, together with an entourage of monastic monks and nuns of the Buddha. And so they're kind of going along the same pace, close together. And this other religious teacher, Well-Loved, is constantly criticizing the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, and finds all kinds of faults in them. And his student is constantly praising the Buddha, Dharma, the Sangha, and saying all the good things. And so this is kind of an interesting beginning, especially in the ancient Indian culture, where students are not supposed to kind of disagree with their teachers in this kind of strong way, especially all day long. And so they're going along, and they're just kind of, you know, talking about this, and the Buddha and their followers, I guess, have to hear this. And they come to the end, end of the day. They both camp in the woods near some place, both parties, and so they're right there, and they just and the well-loved continues to complain, and divinely given continues to praise the Buddha. So, you know, all the Buddhist monks and nuns are hearing this, and the Buddha. The next morning, everyone wakes up, and the Buddhist monastics wake up, and they kind of talk among themselves about what's going on here, because it's kind of, you know, unusual. And what they comment on is, you know, the Buddha doesn't seem to be disturbed at all by this. It's pretty wonderful, they say, how well the Buddha understands the dispositions of people. And we don't know exactly what this expression is about, but supposedly how well the Buddha understands how people function and operate, and you know, knows it well enough not to take it personally, I suppose, and seems to be unperturbed by this. But then the Buddha does call together his monastics, and he says to them, he gives this teaching to them. If someone should be critical, offer dispraise for the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, basically for Buddhism, you shouldn't get angry or hostile. Because if you do that, that'll just be a hindrance for yourself. But if what they say is correct, you should affirm that it's correct, if they're criticism. But if the dispraise is incorrect, you should explain what is correct. So in other words, you don't just kind of, you don't get riled up around it, you don't get angry and hostile, but you don't just simply sit quietly and do nothing. But if you can, if it's possible to have a conversation, you speak up and you explain what is correct and what is not, what you think is going on here. Then the Buddha goes on and he says, if someone comes along and praises the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, Buddhism, if what they're saying is correct, no, in that case, you should not get elated and get all kind of happy and all that they're praising you, because that would be a hindrance for you. But if what they're saying is correct, you should acknowledge it as correct. But if what they're saying is not correct, you should explain what is correct. So that's how the Buddhist scriptures begin. And in a way, it could be seen as this is the attitude, if you enter into the Buddhism, this is the attitude in which you hold what you're about to study and read when you read these scriptures. Clearly it's scripture, clearly it's important for Buddhists, but how you relate to Buddhism, how you relate to these teachings of Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha is an important subject. How you relate to your own religion is an important subject. And you want to relate to Buddhism in such a way that if someone is hostile to it or critical to it, that you don't get angry in return. At the same time, don't be passive. Don't just accept it and just be there. But you would actually explain, if it's possible, what's correct and what's not correct. So, in a sense, this is a teaching of what to do with blasphemy. If there's blasphemy against Buddhism, don't get alarmed, don't get upset. There's not really reason for anger for that. Because if you get angry, it's to your hindrance. It's an obstacle to you. It's a problem for you if you get angry. But you can still do something. But you don't do it in a hostile way. And then if you start looking at more of the other places in this discourse, these collections of things that are taught, There is a story of a man who comes to the Buddha, and he clearly wants to get into a religious debate. And you kind of get the sense they probably came along with a little bit hostile. And he said to the Buddha, what is it that you teach? and he's just ready to kind of like, you know, find fault or find something. And the Buddha replies, I teach that which for something like, I teach that which for which there's no basis to quarrel with anyone. So what do you do if you want to quarrel with someone, debate, and that's what they say? So the person left. And then when they left, then the Buddha gave some teaching to his monastics who were there about what he meant by this. But to have a teaching, we don't quarrel with anyone. And this is around the teaching. You don't argue with and, you know, hold on to it. It's one thing to say what's correct and not to correct, but it's another thing to quarrel and argue what's true. In fact, there's a places where the Buddha said that you shouldn't hold up anything as being the ultimate truth, as being what's ultimate. Because if you do that, it's just more stress for you. But most religions hold up what's ultimate. You know, my religion's more ultimate than yours. And that's why I'm following this religion, not that religion, because this teaches the ultimate, what's most ultimately true. So the Buddha, it's kind of strange that he says, well, and, you know, don't be concerned with what's ultimate. I mean, what good is Buddhism then? Shouldn't Buddhism also teach us what's ultimate? And what the Buddha offers as an alternative to some idea of ultimate truth, ultimate kind of states of mind, ultimate experiences, whatever we want to call it ultimate, what he offers as an alternative is not to cling to anything. But we don't want to take not clinging as ultimate, because then we can get into arguments with people who say that their thing is ultimate. But if you don't cling to anything, including to your religious doctrines, then you won't have any stress around your religion, about Buddhism. So these are all kind of teachings pointing to the idea that that for Buddhists, if you take the Buddhist teachings here, how we relate to Buddhism is actually an important topic. And we want to relate to this Buddhism that some of us have in a way that we're not going to quarrel with people about it. We're not going to hold it up as being ultimate. We're not going to get angry when people criticize it. But because to do so is to get caught up in this little kind of, you know, tension of stress, of reactivity, of anger and all that. The very thing that in Buddhism we're trying to free ourselves from. To free ourselves from being caught in the grip of reactivity and anger and hostility conceit of having the best religion and the best thing. The only thing that I think is good about these terrible stories coming out of Burma and Sri Lanka and a few decades ago in places like Thailand, the only thing that I can think about that it's good is that it kind of benefits some of us who have been thinking that Buddhism is better than the other religions. And people say that Buddhism, there's no war, you know, Buddhists have never had a religious war or something. There's claims like that made. It might be slightly true in some kind of way, but there's plenty of examples of Buddhists who have gone to war and incited violence. There maybe haven't been massive crusades that some religions have done, where they send hordes of children who are innocent to go fight the infidels. All kinds of strange things. But there have been, monasteries in Japan in particular, sometimes in China, who had soldiers as part of the monastery, and they would go down and terrorize, or not terrorize exactly, but they would go down and get their... force their will on the populace and fight each other and things like that. And so to hold Buddhism up as being somehow a better religion because there's more peace, more emphasis on harmony, and certainly everyone who's a Buddhist must be like the Dalai Lama, and, you know, Buddhism's all good, is a little bit of a conceit too, and also kind of obscures what the real, how it's really lived in people's lives. And so then, and because of doing so, it might not, it might prevent us from really seeing carefully how we hold it. Maybe the attachments we have to the very religion which is trying to teach us not to be attached. How we think it's special, and we're special because we're connected to it, the very kind of religion that's supposed to free us from conceit. So that's the only benefit I can see from these Buddhist monastics who are doing, inciting violence in these countries. And then if you look at these ancient texts of the Buddha, he does talk about, the Buddha himself advocates that his people, his monks and nuns and maybe others, that if they investigate and scrutinize something that should be praised, they should praise it. If after investigating and scrutinizing something should be dispraised, they should dispraise it. There was another religious teacher in the time of the Buddha came to the Buddha and said, "Hey, you know, I think the best thing to do is if someone praises you, don't do anything. And someone criticizes something, you know," "the best thing is if what could be praised is praised, and what could be criticized is criticized, after being investigated and scrutinized, so you really understand well what you're doing, the best thing to do is to just do nothing and just abide in equanimity." And that's an attitude of some Buddhists that I've seen. You know, just be cool, just Mr. Natural. And the Buddha says, no. The highest, the best, is if after investigating and scrutinizing, if something is deserves to be praised, it should be praised. If something deserves to be dispraised, it should be dispraised. So it's a little bit surprising for some people to hear that this idea to actively praising and dispraise. So in this regard, one of the things that in the suttas the Buddha repeatedly says we should speak up and do something is if people are killing. He said that a Buddhist should not be involved in killing and should encourage others to not kill. We should not be involved in stealing and should encourage others not to steal. We should not be engaged in sexual misconduct and we should encourage others not to be involved in sexual misconduct. And so he goes on about the whole series of kind of ethical things. So it isn't just kind of a passive teaching. Just sit and be cool and do your practice and just relax and just be equanimous and don't get involved. You know, just let the world out there do what it does, and don't think it's your business and meditate. Then there's an interesting teaching where he says something like, if another, I was talking to his monks, nuns, his monastics, if another monastic is doing something unwholesome, doing something that is kind of is causing harm to himself or to others, then you should encourage that person, actively encourage that person to stop doing those unwholesome things and help establish that person in doing what's wholesome or healthy or appropriate. But you might think that it's troublesome for you to do that. You know, you're meditating, you're peaceful, and you know, you've done a lot, it's been years, you know, finally getting kind of peaceful, you finally have a quiet, peaceful mind, and you know, and so you might think it's troublesome to get up there, and you know, and some of these, you know, difficult monastics, community members, you know, they're kind of, you know, a challenge to talk to. But if you think you can kind of help them to move away from doing the unhealthy thing, the unethical things, the unwholesome things, to do that which is wholesome, even if it's troublesome for you, you should do it. Because what is a trifling a bit of personal trouble compared to the benefit of helping someone live a wholesome life? Isn't that quite something? So, even if it's a little bit uncomfortable, a little bit, you know, challenging, a little bit agitates you, don't kind of hold on to your peace. It's okay to lose some of it. He says some. You know, so the question is, how much is okay, you know, to get uncomfortable? And so the idea is that, you know, we're not supposed to just go around and always be comfortable and peaceful and just chilled out. Sometimes some of the things we're asked to do is uncomfortable to do. But here the Buddha says, step up and help others. So this idea of actively encouraging people to be ethical, actively, you know, stepping forth and helping other people to move from kind of unhealthy ways of living, if they're a fellow practitioner, and to be more healthy, to take some role, you know, step forward and speak. Certainly, I think not aggressively, but you know, certainly speak up and do something. Finally, there was an interesting article published recently in a journal called the Journal of Buddhist Ethics by a woman named professor named Sally King. And she looks at the idea of right speech and how it's talked about in the ancient texts. And it says there that that there's different qualifications that makes for good speech, right speech. It should be truthful. It should be timely. It should be kindly. It should be beneficial, what you have to say, and it should be not harsh speech. So these kinds of things, that's really good speech. That's nice. However, the Buddha says, in some circumstances, what is true, what is beneficial, what is timely to speak, can be done harshly or sharply, and that's still appropriate speech. In other words, sometimes it's appropriate to speak sharply and clearly to what's going on. So she quotes this passage, and maybe it's slightly unusual for this kind of Buddhist journal like this, but she kind of goes through, and she has a whole list of discussion about this whole, how it's talked about, all for the purpose of discussing how it's appropriate for Buddhists in the United States to criticize Donald Trump. Because she's heard that some Buddhists think, well, you're not supposed to be involved, you're supposed to kind of, you know, always have kind and gentle speech and always supposed to mediate and not kind of create any kind of, you know, criticism of anyone and all that. And she wants to argue against this kind of idea that's out there about this kind of thing. And then she points out that one Buddhist teacher wrote in Buddhist magazine recently that we should never criticize a person, but only what they do or what they say. That's in some ways, it's very nice. It's sometimes a very wise approach because it makes it easier to be in dialogue with people. But she says, the Buddha didn't say that. He actually said, sometimes you want to criticize the person. So that's, you know. So for people who have kind of like a little distant relationship to the ancient texts of the Buddha, some of these teachings are a bit surprising. Because the teachings of Buddhism that you get tend to be, you know, you get a selective version of it, and Buddhist teachers like this person in front of you, you know, we have our particular preferences of what we teach and how we teach, and so there's a kind of a selection process that goes on. And so sometimes I certainly don't emphasize this side of the teachings as much. I mean, it's the first time I've ever said some of these things here, right? So I said I wanted to bring it, you know, back to us and our own practice. So it has to do with the nature of the Dharma. So there's three things represent the Buddhism: Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. But the Dharma in particular, the word Dharma is almost synonymous with Dharma, with the Buddha Dharma, with the Buddhist, with Buddhism, for Buddhists. And the question, one of the questions is, where do you find the Dharma? And I would suggest that the so-called teachings of the Buddha, these scriptures, and the teachings that someone like me would teach, are not really the Dharma. They're teachings about the Dharma, and it's kind of like it's fingers pointing towards the Dharma. And the only place you find the Dharma is in yourself. It has to do with how we negotiate our inner landscape. It's only here that only you can be the custodian of your inner life. Other people might have an influence on your inner life, your inner well-being, but to really, the only real true custodian of that inner life can be you yourself. And it's that in that inner life, understanding how it operates and understanding the choices we make, the attitudes we have, the impulses we act on, the reactivity we have, learning how to let go, learning how to find peace in that inner life, learning how to negotiate the world so we kind of maintain a high quality sense of well-being within, that's where the Dharma is found. And that Dharma, there's only one person who can harm. You know who that is? It's yourself. So someone might say terrible things about the Dharma, you know, the teachings, Buddhism. Buddhism is just a bunch of baloney or something. But, you know, that's just information. That's just pointers. That's just ideas. That's about the Dharma. The Dharma's not being harmed by those people. The Dharma doesn't care that people are saying the Dharma is baloney. The Dharma has nothing to do with that world of what people are saying. The Dharma has to do with the world of your heart and how you choose to live from the heart, from the inside out. What are the motivations that you want to live your life by? What are the responses to the world that arises from your heart about how you want to speak, how you want to act in this world? How do you safeguard the best qualities of your heart? How do you find a heart, a mind that's liberated and free and stay close to that freedom? That's really up to you. And only you can kind of get in the way of that. Only you can hinder that. Only you can kind of, you know, tie that up in a knot. And if we get, and in fact I would say that if we get angry and even worse, hostile, because someone is critical or worse, demeans or is, you know, slanders Buddhism, if we get angry, our anger is what destroying the Dharma. It's not what they say. The very thing that if a Buddhist wants to protect the Dharma, you can't protect it by being hostile to the people who are critical. Because the very hostility that arises from within us is the very thing that destroys the Dharma. Because it's found here in us. That's where it is. And the Buddha, criticizing the Buddha, I'm pretty confident the Buddha doesn't care. The Buddha will not be offended. And just like the story of well-love, that opening story, these two people being critical and praising the Buddha, in that situation the Buddha was non-reactive, was equanimous. He didn't buy into it. But he did, next morning, tell his monks, look, you know, don't just put up with this. There are things you can do. You can speak up. So, you know, the Buddha won't care. The Dharma doesn't care, really. But you destroy the Dharma when you get hostile yourself. And then there's a Sangha, which is the community of practitioners. And it's my hope that the community of practitioners understands their hearts well enough that they also will not squeeze out the Dharma from their hearts and destroy it, but will live the Dharma. And in that way, with whatever equanimity they have, and maybe whatever loving kindness and compassion they have, they will sometimes go to the trouble of speaking up when something needs to be criticized, when something needs to be dispraised, when we need to kind of correct what's there and offer a different point of view. That's part of being a Buddhist. Buddhists are not just simply sitting quietly, being, you know, just meditating and letting the world around them just kind of do what it does, as if it has no part of my own life. So at least that's what, the natural conclusion, I think, that comes from studying the Buddha's teachings, which is the guide for, you know, some Buddhists. So that's the idea. And having said that, I will say quite strongly that those people who are inciting violence, those people who are expressing hate for the Rohingya, for the Tamil Muslims in Sri Lanka, that this is actually wrong. That this has no role in a supportive, mutually supportive, compassionate life. And I think we should speak up. So we have about 10 minutes. And now, if anything I've said is worthy of praise, you know, I'll nod if it's correct, and I'll correct it if it's not. And if anything I've said it deserves dispraise, I'll accept it if it's correct and try to do best to correct it if it can be corrected. But I won't be angry. So, any comments or questions or concerns or critiques?
So, I'm wondering if any Buddhist leaders have publicly tried to point a more wholesome way to the Burmese who seem to be killing certain or creating violence. And if so, what did they say?
Yeah, I don't, as far as I know, there's been no direct communication from Buddhist teachers that I know with some of these ultra-nationalistic monks like in Burma. But I do know that some Western teachers have sent petitions to the government in Rangoon concerned with this whole issue and offering rebuttal for it or suggesting other ways. I don't actually know offhand, I can't remember what they actually said, but there have been attempts. But how well those have been received, I don't know. You know, it's quite something that this country will, Burma will, jail someone for putting headphones on a Buddha, but they're quiet when someone is giving talks, Dharma talks, they call it Dharma talks, filled with hate against other people and inciting violence. And, you know, and some of the things that some of these ultra-nationalistic monks in Burma have said has been quite shocking. But no one protests against them. That's not considered blasphemy against Buddhism or a crime against Buddhism or something. So to have access to that, to have people listen to them, it's very hard in those countries. And from many people have been quite disappointed that Aung San Suu Kyi, who was considered such a wonderful representative of nonviolence and nonviolent change, is now seemingly, you know, now that she's become a politician, is disappointing many people for not taking a stronger stand on this. And so people have certainly contacted her, and that's what I know.
Thank you.
Yes, please.
In terms of these really big issues, I think there's some stuff that's very clear that you can say, but you also talked about when you see your fellow practitioners maybe doing something unwholesome to speak up and to help help them out on that. And that feels like that it's really hard to determine if you're, I mean, I feel like there are a lot of situations where people try to help each other out, and it's really not appropriate.
Right.
Or they don't know what's best for someone else or what's going on inside for them. So it just came up for me.
Yeah, it is hard. It is very hard. And not only is it hard to, it's also hard to know what to say and how to speak and how to do it effectively, and depends how open people are for it. But all kinds of things. I remember once when I was a monk at Tassajara Monastery, and I was working in the kitchen. I was kind of the kitchen manager of the kitchen crew. And the monastery kitchens are considered to be pressure cookers for interpersonal challenges. So I was leading this crew and guiding them, getting meals ready and all that. And this man on the crew turned towards me and said in a very, I called it white anger, was a feeling, I don't know if that's an expression, but for me it was like white anger, it was a clean anger. He just said to me, like, bang, he said, "Don't ever do that again." And as soon as he said it, it was gone from him. It was like, you know, it's like, I was more impressed by how quickly he dropped it than I was by what he said. He got his message across, and he wasn't holding it anymore. I got the message. And I understood that I had crossed a line or done something I shouldn't do, and it was all done with. I kind of appreciated that moment. Not that I say, you know, somehow he had the wisdom to know, and he had the ability not to carry it or make it a hostile act, or, you know, or be angry. So how to do things effectively and all that is really hard, and when to speak up is really hard. One Buddhist community I was in, there was a person who was an alcoholic living in the community, and no one knew what to do, and everyone just kind of ignored it and pretended it wasn't happening, and then at some point the person died in his room from alcohol overdose, got sick, you know, sicker and sicker. And then from that, the community said, no, we can't just kind of turn away and not look at this. We have to be able to really face these kinds of things, speak up and address it when it's there in our community. So it's hard, I agree. It takes skill. And sometimes courage.
What's coming up for me is that there is sexual assault and abuse of power within Buddhism and sexism, and that happens and has happened, and so I just want to make sure it's not overlooked that there's classism, sexism, racism within Buddhism.
Oh, absolutely.
Here,
yes.
Now, and people violating other people.
Yes, so today, you know, I was focusing mostly on the most egregious things we see in some of these countries. That's what people come to me and ask me, kind of horrified by it. But even in Buddhism in the West, we have those things. And some of it is pretty egregious, what goes on in Buddhist communities here in the West as well. And that's been hard for Western Buddhist teachers to address and deal with within the teaching community itself. I remember in 1982 that my Zen teacher gathered all of his monastic disciples together and to say that there's this one Zen teacher in America who we don't want anyone to go to that person. We don't want to encourage anyone to go there or having to do with it because of so much abuse that that person had been involved in. And then some years later, when I was more familiar with what was going on in American Zen Buddhism, found out that there were some Zen teachers who had been actively trying to stop this abuse for probably for about 40 years. It went on that long, and but you know, somehow the person went through. You know, his board would resign, and he would just continue. And new people would come, and so there is, it was. You know, it's very hard for some of these self-contained groups to, for someone from outside who has no real authority to come and do something, speak up, and so it's been very unfortunate. There's been Buddhist communities in the West where abuse has gone on for literally decades. And so as a response to this, some Buddhist communities have put together ethics committees, ethics documents. So there are processes by which people in the community can respond and deal with these things. There's procedures and stuff. And the Buddhist communities I'm most familiar with are actively looking at some of these issues you raised and trying to find their way through them. Can we have the mic up here, please?
First, I just really want to appreciate you bringing up this range of topics. It's not an easy range, and I think it's very important that it's brought up publicly and repeatedly, actually. I don't know if there's a short or good answer to this, but I just wonder, in my experience of much of the Western Vipassana community, there's not a lot of energy towards vocal action, and I'm wondering, that might just be my perception, but is there, do you have thoughts on ways of cultivating a culture that is a little bit more oriented towards naming what we see when it is important to offer?
So it's a very broad topic you're bringing. So do you mean within our own communities? Do you mean in our neighborhoods? Do you mean nationally? You mean
I was thinking more in terms of the bigger picture stuff. So with the Rohingya, for example, or Sri Lanka, or larger societal issues.
It's a hard one because not everyone has a disposition, not everyone has the nature that they want to do those kinds of things. So to require it of them, I was very touched many years ago. I studied with a Zen teacher named Robert Aiken. And Robert Aiken was kind of the elder statesman for American Buddhism in the 1970s, 1980s, very dignified man, beautiful man. And he was also one of the founders of Buddhist Peace Fellowship, and an organization that's very much involved in these kinds of issues. And he would go to Central America to be a witness for some of the, kind of a witness, but a protector. He would go live in certain communities where there was potential violence against the members of the community. And if someone from the West, someone from the kind of United States was there, the government, the police, the gangsters, the different people involved in politics would tend not to come and fight or kill someone. So he was would be there as a bodyguard, kind of, sort of whatever it's called. So he was very interested in these kinds of issues. And there were people, when I went to study with him, there were some people who went to study with him only because he had this engaged Buddhist approach. However, there were people who came to study Zen with him who had no disposition towards that direction. And so the people who came to study, do the engaged Buddhism with him, complained to him that he should get everyone to be involved and engaged. Everyone has a responsibility. Everyone should do this. And he said, no, not everyone. People's lives are so different. People's dispositions are so different. People's circumstances and lives are so different that it doesn't make sense to require everyone to do this. If you want to do it, you should do it. It was his reply back. So to answer your question more specifically, what I'd love to see is some Western Buddhists in our scene, the Vipassana scene, English-speaking people, to really start studying, investigate and scrutinize carefully and well Buddhist ethics, Buddhist teachings on these kinds of issues, and how these apply to our national and international life, our public life, and to be capable to be speakers, be capable to be writers about these issues, so in an informed and deep and thoughtful way, they can participate in the public discourse in the right way. But you can't expect people who haven't been trained and educated. I mean, Martin Luther King was so great. He had a PhD. I mean, he was well studied. He'd spent years being a public speaker in a particular way that worked for our country as a whole. You know, it'd be great to have a Martin Luther King come up out of our scene, that kind of person. What kind of training does that person have to get? It's not going to appear out of nothing. So, so I'm hoping that I want to see more people, I want to support people to get that kind of education and to do that kind of exploration, some people. And then those of us who are not going to be that involved will support that person and benefit from that work. And because, you know, it's all of us together and all the different forms that we have that work. We can't expect all of us to do everything. So maybe it'll be one of you. Wouldn't that be nice? I'm waiting. So, thank you all.